I want to hear a little bit about your story and sort of the background history leading up to where you are today. Give us the Reader's Digest of Jim Wallace.
Well, my parents, Jim and Phyllis Wallace, started our little assembly, Plymouth Brethren Assembly, a little evangelical church in Detroit. He was in the Navy, just came home from the war, and so the Plymouth Brethren don't have clergy, pastors, but he would get up every morning at 5 o'clock to read his Bible, then get us up at 7 for work and school. He knew his Bible so well, and he was a mechanical engineer and a businessman, but he was really the pastor of the church. And my mom really was too, but of course, as a woman, she couldn't get credit for what she was doing. So they were really the co-pastors. And it was our life. It was our faith was the most important thing in our family, and the church was my second home. But I was in the Civil Rights Institute in Birmingham with some church leaders this last week, and I went through again the museum there, and I saw the timeline of the Civil Rights Movement in the South. And I remember it was about 1960, as I was watching the events down there. I was 12 years old in Detroit, and I was beginning to pay attention to what was happening in the South. And in my hometown of Detroit, a very polarized, racially polarized city. And I saw what was happening in the South and Detroit as relevant to my faith. And no one else around me did. We were taught to sing, Jesus loves little children. All the children of the world, red and yellow, black and white, they are precious in his sight. But the only children on my side, only people on my side, were white people. And I asked, how come we live the way we do in white Detroit and life seems so different? In black Detroit, just a few miles or blocks away, how come there been to a black church, didn't have a black preacher ever come visit us? And the questions just came from my soul somewhere. I was just a young teenage kid. But they seemed like the most important thing in my city was how divided we were. And I thought, certainly, this faith that's so important to us has to be relevant to that, to bring us together. But it wasn't. And I asked why. They told me I was too young to ask this kind of questions. And so I tell young people, trust your questions. Trust your questions. And follow them, you know, follow where they take you. That's what I did. They said, when you get older, you'll understand. Or some said, we don't know why it's that way, but it's always been that way.
Yeah.
One honest answer was, if you keep asking those questions, son, you're going to get in a lot of trouble. And that proved to be true. So I went into the city, and I began to walk the streets, and I ran into black churches, you know, and I went in, and, you know, they loved the same Jesus and read the same Bible and sang out of the same hymnal, but made it sound so much better than we did.
Yeah.
And I came home to my church with black friends, and new answers and new questions. And I remember one night an elder said to me, Jim, Christianity has nothing to do with racism. That's political, and our faith is personal. I was about 14, and that's the night that I think I left in my head and my heart. And in 2 years, I was gone. Found my way into the Civil Rights Movement and the student movements of my time. But here was the issue that was ripping my city and my country apart, and they said it wasn't relevant to Christian faith. And I just couldn't believe that was true. So I came back to faith later on after years of organizing in those movements. But that's a different story. I came back really reading the New Testament for the first, well, not the first time because I grew up with it, but as an adult, not having been tear gassed and we could put 10,000 people in the street in those days in 2 hours.
Wow.
But it wasn't enough for me. I wasn't satisfied with Ho Chi Minh, Che Guevara, and Karl Marx, so I began to read the Bible again, because I never quite got shit of Jesus this whole time,
yeah.
Even though I'd been kicked out of the church. So I was reading the Sermon on the Mount, and that really, I never read anything as radical as that to change my life and the world. And then I got to Matthew 25, and that became my conversion text. Jesus said, I was hungry, I was thirsty, I was naked, I was sick, I was a stranger, I was in prison, you weren't there for me, and you didn't come to me. And all the people said, well, we didn't know it was you. And they said, as you've done to the least of these, you've done to me. And I thought that was more radical, I guess, than anything I ever read in Karl Marx or Che Guevara. So I signed up, became a follower of Jesus and went to seminary at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School. And that was the beginning of where Sojourner started way back in those days.
Yeah, so tell us a bit about the Sojourner story. You're obviously the founder or CEO of Sojourners. A lot of our audience are familiar with Sojourners. They're part of your community. But give us a little bit about the organization, what the mission is.
Well, Sojourners really is a metaphor for the church. We're a pilgrim people. We're on a journey. And I think it's really at its best a movement, a network, an extended community around the world now, really. And it's trying to talk about the personal faith that really expresses itself in love and justice and concern for the world. For me growing up, the question was always, what does my faith mean for the world? How it should change the world was always, for whatever reason, that was the question that God put on my heart early on. What does this mean for the world? God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believes in him should not perish but everlasting life. I heard that as a kid, John 3:16. And for the rest of the church, the focus was on everlasting life. And I was all for that, still am. But I said, but God so loved the world. God loves this world. How do we show that we love the world like God does? And so Sojourners is about that. It's really about how our faith, what it means to have a real personal faith, to be changed, have our lives changed by Jesus Christ, and then how that makes us, God's hands and feet in the world, partners with what God wants to do in the world, and so that's our focus.
Yeah, and I love the approach Sojourners has always taken in terms of in many ways you take on issues and you're a voice for the voiceless, and so much of that stems, as you mentioned, out of your upbringing and your background and your history and just your perspective. Talk about the current sort of place at the table that Sojourners have, because I think our audience would be interested in knowing that we have this voice among the influential table that you have as well as the organization does.
Well, you know, Billy Graham was in our house every crusade we watched, and he was the one that we just loved, and he was very kind and to early years of Sojourners. And I remember one of the last times that we talked, he put his hands on my shoulders and said, "Jim, you stood for things and issues that none of the rest of us have really been willing to stand for. And that's why I've always supported you." And I tell you, that meant more to me than anything ever Time Magazine or Jon Stewart or anybody else ever said.
Yeah.
Because I grew up with Billy Graham's proclamation of the gospel. And what he said to me is my vocation has been to talk about, that personal faith in Jesus Christ. And yours has been to talk about the implications and meaning of that faith in the world. And, when he said that to me the first time, I was a young kid when he said that to me. And it just, that's been my vocation. And the Bible really measures a society, the prophets do, not by their gross national product or their military firepower or their popular culture being the envy of the world, but by how we treat the poorest and most vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really the sort of the biblical test of a society or of our politics. And so we've tried to say, how does this impact the poor, the refugees, or the women and children, the widows and orphans, the victims of war, the civilian casualties, those who are left out and left behind? That's always, I always say, the God question is, but how are the children? Well, we're the richest nation. Well, yeah, but how are the children doing? And I think that's really what has motivated us over all these years.
Yeah. Well, I want to ask you about your most recent book and also God's Politics. But let's talk a few minutes about Rediscovering Values, which is your most recent book, subtitle Moral Compass for the New Economy. And it seems that the book has struck a chord across a number of different industries and economic, sociopath, whatever that is. It seems to be this this thing that everybody is wanting to grab a hold of. Obviously, there's a reason for that, but talk about the book and why you think it's struck such a chord.
Well, Brad, this is, to me, a very kind of surprising and funny thing. Like, next week, I'm going to be moderating and leading the opening session at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. This is the third year in a row that I've been in a plenary session to talk about values, values in the market. And all these executives are coming to me like Nicodemus at night, you know, to talk about, I've lost something. I've lost my faith, or I've lost the values of the stories my mother read to me going to bed at night, or why I got in the business in the first place, and I've just lost that somehow. And so now I've been asked to, this is a very surprising thing to me, but I've been asked to chair something called the Moral Economy Dialogue for the World Economic Forum, and it's going to be a 3 or 4 year project. I'm chairing the Global Council on Values. They've never had one before. It's been councils on minerals and branding and water. Now it's values.
Wow.
And so we're beginning the whole Davos meeting with a plenary session on values, norms, and behavior. Because that's what's gone wrong. And these executives, these bankers and others who tell me, they use words like it's been greed and risk and unnecessary risk and selfishness and recklessness that's got us in this crisis. Those are their words. And they're trying to look at that from the prism of values. So I never thought a religious leader would have that chance at Davos. But we're having this whole delegation now of faith leaders there. And I think it's a very important dialogue. So, you know, I'll be now at a business school, which has not been the usual environment I've spoken at before. And I can say to these executives at the Wharton School this summer, I said, I'd like to overhear your conversation about how do you move from an ethic of endless growth to an ethic of sustainability, which is another word for what you and I called stewardship.
Yeah.
And they're open to that conversation. They shake their heads. Yes, we have to look at that. So I've been saying this crisis, the right question is not when will the crisis end. Of course, we all want to know that. But how will the crisis change us is a much better question. So the book, it's coming out in paperback, I think, February 1st. And a lot of churches are using it for their Lenten studies. Faith in economics and faith in, you know, values. And this is not a congregational issue, a pastoral issue, an issue of unemployment and real suffering in our congregations. You know, so stories of how Christians are trying to think in Christian ways about the economy.
Yeah.
So I have really learned a lot, and I'm having new conversations with people, new alliances, and it's really stretching me and teaching me a great deal.
Well, I think what's a very practical application from that is that for church leaders who are listening, pastors, you know, volunteer leaders, but somebody in a local context of a church, the conversation with the business community and the marketplace is very open, and you're sort of approaching it from the idea of, you know, it's about values, but you're being invited into the conversation. And, you know, for so many of us, sometimes we feel like if we're in the church or we're Christian, we really don't have a seat at the table. But from what you're hearing and sensing and actually getting invited to, that's not the case.
Well, I think the crisis sometimes opens people to a conversation they wouldn't have before been before. And so I think we should be very clear, particularly with these folks who are in our congregations, and say it is right to ask what it means to think and act and behave in a Christian way, live in a Christian way in regard to these economic choices and values and this conversation. It affects a lot of our people who are unemployed and who are struggling and suffering. Their houses are underwater, and we need a pastoral response to them. And yet the business people, I think, are more than ever needing some help. And I think we need to enter right into that conversation. Tony Blair was on the panel with me the first year of the crisis, and it was on values in the market. He said, Jim, they must be in crisis to have a panel at Davos on values and invite someone like you to speak. That must be a crisis. So crisis can be, you know, the my son's taking Chinese in the seventh grade, and I was helping him with his homework too, as best I could, and I realized again the Chinese word for crisis, or the symbol, is a combination of the two symbols in Chinese for danger and opportunity. Mm. And I think that really is now the opportunity we have.
Yeah. Well, I want to ask you too about next generation leaders and young leaders. You spend a ton of time around 20-somethings, you know, college students, 30-somethings. What are you sensing, hearing from young leaders, and particularly those who would consider themselves followers of Christ? But what's sort of your gut right now in regards to the next generation?
Well, I feel very blessed that a now 60-year-old guy, every time I go out and speak, half the audiences are under 30, almost every time, and half of them under 25. And I'm doing a lot of listening, you know, after it's over late at night. And I think I'm very hopeful. I want to say that I'm very encouraged by this new generation. They want their lives and their faith to make a difference in the world. They really do. And they're not sucking all the old baggage, the religious right, religious left. I'm saying, don't go left, don't go right, go deeper.
Yeah.
What are the moral questions right beneath our public debates? And so Georgetown is, I'm teaching there this fall, and I get the last class is always on vocation. Mm. The difference in career and vocation. Mm. Career is you assemble your assets and your resume, and you try to find what rung on the ladder of success can you get on and make it quickly. Vocation is to discern your gifts. What do you lose track of time when you're doing? What's down, deep gut, soul stuff? What are you really good at? What we probably put on this earth to do? Where your gifts meet the crushing needs of the world, that's your vocation right there. Where your gifts meet the crushing needs of the world, that is your vocation. And the students are just wide-eyed at that point, and I say, you know, I don't teach this course for the money or for the resume, but the privilege of, for right now, after 10 weeks, now you're asking questions about what you're going to do with your lives. All your reflection papers suggest that, the class discussions. And when I'm with a group of young people talking about what they're going to do with their gifts, time, and energy, I'm standing on holy ground.
Hmm. Wow.
And so I feel very, very privileged to be in conversation. My staff is a young staff, a lot under 30, senior staff, 30s. I have some senior staff who are 26. I think something is happening. There's been a real shift. There's kind of a, Rich Cizik calls it a slower earthquake. Hmm. But I see it in a new generation of men and women who really want to make a difference in the world. I see it in my own kids. They're 12 and 7. I got a late start. And my own kids, we watched Gandhi together on the anniversary of Dr. King, because my 7-year-old said, Dad, tell me what Gandhi was like. And I said, well, let's watch the movie tonight and see. And the conversations with those two boys at bedtime at night are amazing, their prayers and their questions. So I'm really hopeful about a new generation now, and I'll spend as much time with them as I possibly can. That's partly why I'm a little league baseball coach.
Yeah, and I want to ask you about that in a second. I got to ask you too with the anniversary of Dr. King just 2 days ago. You know, you've seen such a shift in our country in so many ways, and you've seen a shift even among the evangelical Christian community of, you know, where the social gospel or sort of thinking about justice and thinking about your neighbor and the poor was seen as, well, that's really not what we need to be doing. Whereas now, even with younger leaders, that seems to be part of their DNA. And do you see that, Jim, as a hey, that's here to stay? You know, because we get that question a lot with, well, is this just a fad for this generation? Is this just they're trying to find a cause they can you know put something on their wrist? What are your thoughts around that whole idea?
Well, really, it's a holistic gospel. We have to move away from the privatized gospel that I grew up with in the evangelical world, and the social gospel, which is kind of ended up being more kind of liberal politics in the mainline Protestant world, and talk about a holistic gospel, a biblical gospel that changes lives and neighborhoods and nations and all the rest. And I think that's what they're being drawn to, this new Christian generation now. And Tim King, who's my communications director, he's 26, and he went to North Park University. And we went and spoke there together this fall. It was really fun. We did a tag team. And I talked about this vision of the gospel that really can inspire us and change our lives and change our world. And they were all excited. And Tim gave the altar call. And he said, now, as you can hear, I sat there in where you are right now hearing Jim Wallace speak to me in chapel. And now I'm up here in front. And I want to say to you, you can hear that Jim believes in us. He believes in our generation. But I think the jury's still out, he said. Are we going to just do this for a year or two, or a project, mission trips, and wear a wristband? Or are we going to make our vocations consistent with this gospel message of personal transformation and social justice? Are we going to have vocations that really make justice more possible, that really witness to the kingdom of God in the world? Are we going to do that with our lives, not just a phase of our lives? It was a very powerful altar call, and he was the right one to give it to his own generation. So I'm hopeful, but I think the choices that we make in our lives about our vocation, our energy, our time, that's going to determine whether this really is a lasting thing or not. I think it can be. I think it will be.
Yeah. Well, and you are you're constantly in the media, you're in the news, you're on the talk shows. Another more recent event that we've been dealing with is the shooting in Tucson and the president's speech. I want to get your take on the president's speech on really civility, and then secondly, I want you to talk about this whole idea of being a part of the conversation in the media, and how so much of the media wants to paint everybody as hating each other and against each other. And because I think you have another side that I would love for you to share with our audience.
Congressman Giffords, Gabby Giffords, who lies in a hospital bed in Tucson, is a friend of mine. I know Gabby. I know Mark, her husband. I was with them over New Year's at a retreat just the week before she was shot. So this hit me pretty personally and pretty hard. My kids, he's an astronaut, her husband. My kids have, in the kids program of the retreat, heard him talk about what it's like to fly around space. So they knew who he was, and I, you know, she's a great hugger. Congress people aren't always great huggers. She's a great hugger. And so I gave her a big, big hug. She had a tough race in the fall, and we were on panels together, and this is at the Renaissance Retreat Weekend in South Carolina. So I was just with her, and then this happened. I hope this has the power to make us really reexamine our lives, our choices. The president, I think, gave one of the best speeches he's ever given. I think that and his Philadelphia speech on race were his two best speeches. I think sometimes in the last couple of years, he's kind of lost his voice on a number of things. But he found his voice again, I think partly as a dad, when he talked about that 9-year-old girl. That's the same age as his daughter, Sasha. I think it really impacted him, and he really rose above the finger-pointing and the partisan self-aggrandizing back and forth, and says that, no, there's no single causality in a terrible, evil event like this. And we don't know what's in the mind of the killer in his heart, but you know, this must cause us to look at how we talk to each other, how we respect each other, how we listen to each other. And I believe in conviction and civility. Dr. King could never be accused of not being passionate about the issues he cared about. But he didn't want to win over people. He wanted to win them over. And he was always ready to listen and to show respect. And I think, you know, to say so, I think you're wrong, brother, is different to say, I think you're evil.
Yeah.
Or you're not a patriot, or you're not really a Christian, or you're not a real American. Or when we demonize people, we poison the public square. So we need robust debate, you know. I think there are moral issues involved in many of these public discussions. Let's be clear, let's be strong, but let's understand that each of our adversaries has been made in the image of God. And adversaries are not the same thing as enemies. And even with enemies, Jesus says, love your enemies. You know, this is more challenging than our usual discourse here. So I hope we can learn from this. I see members of Congress going to sit next to each other at the State of the Union. This is a good thing.
Yeah.
But we need more than that. We need people to really be respectable, be responsible, or accountable, I think, to a much more civil discourse. Civil and moral discourse is what we terribly need. Chuck Colson and I have written a joint op-ed about this that will be out soon. Chuck and I often don't vote for the same people or don't have the same view take on policies, but we are absolutely committed together that we need a more moral and civil discourse in this country, and we're going to call for it together.
Yeah. Well, and isn't it? It's so important to have that relationship, too, you know, because when you consider somebody a friend, it's much easier to have a dialogue and a conversation than it is to have a screaming argument.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And a new generation can model that. I mean, we don't want the kind of the style of the cable television talk show host. I often write at night, so I'm surfing the news, and frankly, when you go to between Fox and MSNBC, the politics are different, but the tone is much the same.
Mm-hmm.
And so how do we transcend that and have a different kind of conversation where truth and civility are both highly valued?
Yeah, that's good, man. Hey, a couple more questions. I want to ask you, because you have been around some of the greatest leaders, you yourself being a great leader, but are there leaders that come to mind for you over your lifetime that stand out as, wow, I learned so much from this person?
When I was a kid growing up, I think I found and tried to listen to or read every sermon by Dr. King. But I'd have to say that it would be Nelson Mandela.
Hmm.
And I think that's because he had 27 years of spiritual formation in prison. He had a time of trial in which he really emerged as the kind of leader that we saw when he finally was let out of prison. Desmond Tutu is a friend of mine, and being with him has just taught me. He looks like Yoda, but he's an amazing character. And I got to meet Mandela after he got out of prison and came to the U.S. And I think there's a quality of leadership in him, of forgiveness.
Hmm.
I mean, who could have suffered more than he did? And yet he came out of prison and, along with Desmond Tutu, began to speak of reconciliation and truth and of forgiveness. And if it hadn't been for those two, South Africa would have been a very different place, I think. So I admire. I think Mandela was more important, finally, than Winston Churchill in terms of a model of leadership.
That's good. And for you, like is there one or two lessons that you constantly pass on to? You know, the young leaders you're around, the leaders in their 20s, if somebody said, hey, Jim, what are the one or two key things that every 20-something should know based on your experience and your leadership lessons over the years, what would those be?
I think you've got to be what you say. You've got to do what you call for. I mean, Gandhi says famously, be the change you want for the world. When I talked to my students, I said, there's this Greek notion of truth and knowledge, which is you memorize stuff and then spit it back at the right time. The Hebrew notion is something isn't true until it's changed your life in some way, until it's made a difference in how you live. And so I think what young people admire is courage, and they admire integrity, people who are trying to live by what they say. We're all flawed, we're all human, we all fail, we have lots to learn, lots to confess, but I think the commitment to live it and not just talk it, as we say in my neighborhood, you got to walk your talk.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's more than. And the other thing I'd say is the proverb really is true. Without a vision, the people perish.
Yeah.
And when people are perishing or feel it there, they feel angry and afraid. And I think we have to cast a vision. People are looking for vision. They're looking for integrity, looking for courage. And finally, I'd say, finally, I think people look to us as people of faith for hope, not optimism. That's not the same thing. But hope is a decision, not a feeling, not a mood, not a state of mind. Hope is a decision we make because of our faith. And I love the Hebrews text that faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. My best paraphrase of that is hope means believing in spite of the evidence and then watching the evidence change. That's what Tutu and Mandela and King, all of my heroes, did that. And that's what I think is required of us.
That's great. And I got to ask you, as we wrap up, you consider one of the great joys of your current life coaching Little League baseball.
Yeah.
Talk about your team. Are you winning?
Well, I've coached my son Luke since he was 5, and now Jack also since 5. Luke is 12 now, and Jack is 7. I've got 3 rules on my teams. One is we're going to have fun. The whole point of this is to have fun. I want you to have fun, guys, or girls. I got girls and guys in the team. Second, we're going to learn to be good teammates. The one thing I won't ever tolerate is negative talk from parents, coaches, or kids. Someone makes a mistake, what do you say? Like, get them next time. You know, you're going to encourage each other. I don't want any negative talk ever. It's the only thing I'll get mad about. Third is we're going to learn baseball.
Yeah.
Learn to love baseball. You can become better baseball players. So with those simple rules, we tend to do pretty well. We've won a lot of games, but those things are much more important than winning games. My son Luke now is 12. He's on 3 teams. This will be the last year I co-coach him. He's way ahead of me in skills. I mean, he could coach me now. So I'm a dad coach, not one of those real coaches that he is now on a school team and the all-star team. But I think, you know, what I try and do is just motivate kids, you know, to be better baseball players, to learn to be good teammates, to have fun, and to really, really grow together as a team. If I have a good team where people are really acting like a team, then you're going to lose some games, win some games, but finally in the end, you'll do fine. And I love being on the field. We live next to the baseball field. I love being on the field where all I am is Luke's dad or Coach Jim.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah. Well, hey, man, thanks for the time. Thanks for your leadership. Thanks for modeling for so many of us what it looks like to live out our faith and to do that in a way that is a voice for the voiceless and for so many who need help. So we appreciate your leadership.
Well, Brad, what you're doing is really important. Catalyst is really an important voice. And a lot of us, we really have an investment in you and the people that you reach. It's almost like that Hebrews 11 text, you know, we're surrounded by such a cloud of witnesses. And the best interpretations of that text say that there's people almost in the stands that are cheering for you on the field. And a lot of us, I think, are really cheering for a new generation on the field, that they'll be faithful to the whole gospel and they'll give Christian faith a better name that sometimes had for a while. So God bless you.